you to Brutally. I hope you got a little bit tired of writing interfaces yesterday. So obviously there's sort of ways of avoiding this. Then today I'll show you what interfaces are really good for. So suppose you don't want to write an interface for your function or for your subroutine, but you still want the possibility that the compiler will actually check what's going on. Well, you have two choices, the first one here is that you can write what are called internal functions. And it would look like this. You would have a program. And just to clarify something, all my programs are called test. It's just for lack of imagination. You can call them anything you like. Again, we have a declaration part. And as we talked about yesterday, the declaration part is largely just instructions for the compiler to figure out how things are supposed to be set up. So let's suppose that there's a real there that we call y. Then we have an integer here, and I call that n. Then I have some statements that I'm not going to tell you about right now. But then at the end, before we write our statements, in program test, then I can do a new statement that you might not have seen before. I can write contains. And what I simply do there is that I write the function that we looked at yesterday. So I can write something like function fun here of x, and again we say that the result is going to go into the variable that we call value here, and then we can have our declaration statements here, and of course we have to end the function fun here. So there are two things that I want to point out that that are sort of important here. This is something that you want to do if you're interested in your program running fast. Why? Because this can typically be called what is called inline. So by that we mean that the compiler will actually take this code here and substitute it in when we write, for instance, something like this up in the actual program, right? That's slightly different from the way we talked about how a function would be called yesterday, where I said, well, whenever we did a function call, I would actually put something on a stack and then transfer control of the actual program to the function. And then when the function would finish, then we transfer control back. And then we remove things from the stack. And you can probably assume that there's a fair amount of overhead with that. For very simple functions, this is not really needed, because I can simply take the codes here and substitute it in. And there was, in Fortran before, there was facilities for what was called statement functions and so forth. And that's all for optimization purposes. So simple functions that you're not using extensively all over the place, it's a good idea to put them in here. Then there is another thing that, oh, you had a question?
Yeah.
It's a keyword.
Okay. Does it have to go on a separate line?
Yes. Again, there are probably ways around this, but in general, the usual structure of any Fortran program is one statement per line. If you want to put more than that, then you have to separate them with a semicolon.
So there's no block. So Where does the contains part end?
It ends when the program, with the end program test.
Okay.
And you can actually put more than one function there, and you can also put subroutines in there. The tricky thing here is something I'll tell you a little bit more about later. The function here can do something that is unusual in Fortran, because I can take the value, which is the variable that I'll be returning, and then I can set it equal to the incoming argument, but then, so if you want to write the power in Fortran, you do it with two stars here. Then I can set it equal to x to the power n. Now, that's obviously a somewhat silly way of writing a function, but this is just for illustration purposes. So why is this peculiar? Well, it's peculiar because I haven't mentioned here in the declaration part of the function the variable n. But it does occur up here, right? So these functions and subroutines that you put into a contain statement or a contain part of a program, they actually have access to the main variables of the calling program. And that's unusual in Fortran. It's quite common in other programming languages that you do tricks like this. And you have a question?
Yeah, does the function scope then hide the program scope? If you declare a Y in there, is that legal or?
Yes, you can do that.
Okay.
But it's
obviously.
So I'll tell you a little bit more about the scope rules in Fortran, and basically. So what we're talking about here goes under the name of scope rules, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that shortly. So this is sort of a nifty little trick, and the way I usually think about it is that if you have code here that is repeated, and you don't really want to go the full way and write a function, and you still, or a subroutine, and you still want something that runs really fast, then you can put it down here, and you may not need to transfer all the variables because you still have access to the variables in the calling program. And as you pointed out, this can give rise to some confusion because if you have names that are overlapping and so forth. Okay, so this was one way of doing what is called internal functions, and we can do something else. So let me just tell you two words about what are called subroutines. And it's very simple here. You can just take anything that I told you about functions, but we just have no return value. Otherwise, they look entirely identical to the point where you sometimes forget about using functions, or the other way around, that you sort of only use functions. So a typical subroutine would look something like this. Instead of the keyword function, then you just write subroutine. And you don't have give it the standard name, and the standard name here is always sub. Functions are called fun, and subroutines are called sub, right? So we don't have to declare any return value here, so there's none of the stuff with the result here. But now you can see that typically we might have many arguments here, and we can actually make it sort of work like a function, because I can declare my intentions by writing intent in on x. I can then now say that, oh, by the way, my variable y here, that's supposed to have a return value of something, and maybe I can even do two of them. Or maybe I can say, well, actually, set the last one, it's going to be both, right? So it'll be in and out here. And then we do some statements, and then I end the subroutine. And usually we, it should end by writing end subroutine sub here. From the main program, what we do here is that we have the program test, and it ends here. And then, perhaps not very elegantly, but when I want to transfer control of the program to the subroutine, the way it's done is I do call sub here, and then maybe with three actual arguments that are being transferred to the subroutine. Okay, but basically you can take anything that I said about functions, and it applies to subroutines as well. And particularly I can stack them in here in a contain statement. And so I can have a couple of functions here, and I can have a couple of subroutines as well. And it makes for sort of a rather efficient programming. So we talked about call by reference and call by value yesterday. And this is sort of some of you already know about this, but that's probably not all of you. So I just want to go through this carefully because it's something that will apply to any programming languages, any programming language. So let's just see carefully what it means. So in particular, we want to look at what happens when we encounter a statement like this.
The usual way to call subroutine is to write the program and write call sub, right? My question is, can we use contains as saying contains subroutine? Does it work with subroutine as well?
Sure. So you're going to have two subroutines here. So I started teaching courses with sort of modern versions of Fortran not that long ago. And even the best compiler that we got our hands on, for some reason, it would crash if you put two functions in there. You could do one, but not two. And I think they managed to get rid of bugs in the compilers like this today, so you can just put in what you like. So I'm just going to erase this. And
So the function is written within program and end program, while a subroutine is written outside of program and end program within the same file. Is that right?
I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment here that it's a free country. You can do whatever you like.
Okay, so the function can be outside.
So you can put it in a contained statement here. You can put it right after the program.
But then the contained statement is not necessary.
No, and it changes slightly the behavior, because if you put it here after the main program, then I won't have access to the variables in the calling program. You do have that if you put it after a contained statement. If you put it in a separate file, then obviously you don't have access to the clock calling program's variable either, but it gives you the advantage that you don't have to compile that subroutine whenever you're compiling the main program or the other way around. So typically, a serious programming project will involve many files that you're not always compiling. For instance, if you have a routine for doing Fourier transforms, then you probably figured that out 10 years ago, and you may just include it, but you only want to compile it once. And then you get to the point where you probably lost the source file for it, so there's actually no way you could ever compile it again. So you would then really rely on the fact that you can compile modules and sub-programs independently. Okay, any other questions? So I want to tell you about this call by value, which is the, well, I wouldn't say the opposite, but as opposed to what's called call by reference. I would also say that there are many other names that this goes by, but the idea is always the same. So we have some structure like this, and then let's assume here that I have also a local variable that I call I, and then we have a stack here, and in computer science, well, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the stack is always growing downwards. Well, I don't know why, but it was when I studied computer science. So when we put something on the stack here, it's going to go in here. And that would be sort of a procedure frame for this subroutine. And typically, that procedure frame is it starts with the first bytes here that would be allocated to the arguments here. Okay? So the question is, what should those arguments be? And let's assume here that our call, when we call the subroutine, is actually with three real constants, 1, 2, and 3. So it would be very natural to then assume that what goes on the stack here is then simply the values 2, 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. And then after that, you typically allocate space on the stack for your local variable, in this case, I here. That naturally leads to the fact that, I think I told you yesterday, then if you have a subroutine like this and you declare local variables, it's going to take space up here on the stack, and that means that at some point you're going to run into a limitation. But so very innocently, I suggested that our, well, actually, let me write this differently. Let's assume here that we have A, B, and C here, and then I have A equal to 1.0, B equal to 2, and C equal to 3. Then if the values that A, B, and C here, they have, if they're copied onto the stack, then this is what we call call by value. Okay? The other possibility is that we, when we transfer control to the program, then we don't actually copy the values that A, B, and C have, but instead we transfer what is called a reference. So that would be the memory location of the variables
A, B, and C.
And then again, we would have I here, right? So what would be going in here would be the memory location, or let's just call it the address here of A. So if you talk about call by value, it's sort of working with a photocopy of something, whether as call by reference, as this is called here, that's like you always get the original. When you then do operations on the arguments here in your subroutine, if you're working with a programming language that uses call by reference, then you would actually be modifying the variables in the calling program, right? Because what happened was that it was a memory location that was transferred. So if I do something here to the incoming argument, it will be done also on the variable B from the calling program. Here, if I'm working on a paradigm of call by value, that doesn't happen. So is that clear? The distinction is between working on a copy and working on the original. Yeah? Yes. So that's the most important thing. This is Fortran. And the reason for this is, of course, that it's a design decision that the arguments that you would transfer here would probably be an array that would contain the data that just came out of a scattering experiment on some kind of great big detector, and it takes up maybe half a terabyte. That would just be unthinkable to make a copy of, because just the simple fact of copying it would take you most of the afternoon. So you always then decide that you want to transfer a reference and do it that way.
This isn't so important, but typically, even in languages like C++, where you have call by value, like large things like arrays are still passed by reference. So is there also a performance reason why even things like integers and single bytes are passed by reference? Is that also a performance reason?
Here, no. Yeah, so you're right. In C++, of course, you have the choice. You can decide whatever way you want to do it. Fortran here, it's usually no. You always do it by reference. And then what you can do today is this in and out. You could say that, okay, suppose I'm transferring a single byte, it would be more efficient to make a copy, but that's just not the way it works. Yes. So this, you can see that this was something that came in around the definition of Fortran 90, because people simply got tired of the fact that you get so used to this that mentally you forget, and in particularly you write a function which is just evaluating the cosine of x, and you're hardwired to think that x is not being modified, and I do this about once a year. You know, or the other one that I have a variable which is I, right? And then I send it to a function, and then I forget to declare it as intent in, and I waste about a week or two figuring out that, oh, by the way, it was, I added one to it in the subroutine or something like this. That's why we should use these intent in and out.
I have to ask, just because you say it's, it's a design decision for optimization.
Well, let me say it this way: in 1958, when the first Fortran compilers were built, then this was the decision that was made, and not so much, in my opinion, for optimization as for the fact that the typical data sets you would be working with in scientific computing are huge. That's totally different from the way C was developed and which was for basically coding Unix. So operating system calls have arguments that are tiny, and you would never take the risk of doing call by reference by standard. I don't think anybody would ever try to write a Unix operating system in Fortran. you have programming languages for different purposes, right? So C is optimal for that. It was developed for that and eventually evolved into C++. So anyway, those are the two issues here. And whenever you look through your newest, fanciest programming language that you really want to use, you should always keep in mind, oh, what actually happens when I'm calling a function and when I'm calling a subroutine. And what am I working under, called by value or called by reference? Okay, so there's one other tricky thing here that I want to tell you about because it'll come in later. That's when so we transfer control of the program to the subroutine here. And then at some point, the subroutine will end. So you could ask yourself, what will happen to my local variable here when the subroutine ends? So that will play as an important part later. So you could ask yourself, what happens to I when sub here finishes? And does anybody want to venture a guess? What?
I'm hoping it gets deleted automatically.
We could actually go and try it. Well, you would assume something like this, that it somehow ceases to exist. But then depending on the memory management and how you call your subroutine, it could actually be that the next time when you call the function of the subroutine, that you could actually find its value. But the usual answer here is that I here, it goes what we call out of scope. By this we mean that no currently executing subprogram is accessing it, and so it becomes formally undefined. And if you're relying if your program relies on the fact that you can access it, then you're doing very risky programming. So we can keep it around. That can be done simply by saying here in the declaration part, so we would have our subroutine here that we call sub x, y, z here. And then we had some stuff here. When I reach my integer, that we call I here, then I just give it another attribute. So that's the name of the game, that before the two colons here, there will be a number of attributes that we can come by. You saw that we could declare them parameter yesterday, and we can declare them intent in and out. Here I can tell it to save it. So that would usually mean that it goes not on the stack, but is actually allocated space over on the heap. So the first time I call the subroutine, it will be initialized to zero. But on subsequent calls, it will keep whatever value it had when it exited the last time. So if you want to keep counters around and stuff like this, that's very convenient. So they don't have to disappear completely. Okay. So.
Like if you have two subroutines and both of them have variable called I, are they both going to use the same?
No. I mean that's it'll be local to that variable, right?
So the new subroutine can back to this very same subroutine, more or less remember where I was.
Precisely how that is implemented is, so there are things that might be defined in, so there's an ANSI committee that defines a Fortran standard. Things are often left up to the compiler vendor. So precisely how they do this could vary. Other questions?
So if you have a subroutine in a different file and we save a variable, you can still access it from the main program.
You can access it from the subroutine.
From the subprogram.
Yes. So the way you should think here is that Fortran was intended for precisely what you're doing now, scientific programming, and it's relying on huge libraries. If you look at LaTeX that you might have come by, or IMSL, if you start digging down in the layers, you'll find Fortran 66 code that was actually developed in the early 60s. Then people sort of tried to hide it between various layers. But it's the same code here. So you're building on this experience in developing these libraries that are 40 years old. So you if you import LaTeX, then you absolutely don't want to know anything about its internal variables and whatever is going on there. And that brings me to what I'm going to tell you about right now. That's scope rules. I almost already told you the punchline here. So I have again my program test, maybe it'll have a real here. Let's actually take three of them, x, a, and b here, and b we then set equal to 7, and then I set a equal to fun of x here, and then I would end my program. Then I have to also write my function. So I would write function fun here of x, and it has some result that goes into value. Then it has a real here that's x, an integer that we call I, and probably really I should put in the intent in here, but my arms are getting tired. So you can also see that I missed an implicit none. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't be doing that when you write your programs, right? So I could get the idea that maybe I should say that the value that my function should be returning should be should be the sign of B. And that might make sense. Admittedly, this is a silly example. But it might make sense to someone. Because B here is well known in the calling program. And maybe that's, for whatever strange reason, the behavior that I desire. But this here will not work here because B is what we call out of scope. So basically, scope rules here, they will define the program unit that has access to a variable name. And in Fortran, we have what is called a flat scope rule. And in summary here, it means that variables can only be accessed from within the defining program unit. There is one exception, which I'm not sure if you really want to call that an exception, and that was the one I just told you about. So the exception here, that was this internal function subroutine. But really, you want to say that since the contain statement is inside the main program, then we're not really outside the same programming unit. So if you haven't programmed extensively before, this may seem like I'm telling you a lot of things about nothing. If you have programmed in other programming languages that have sort of extensive, and particularly Pascal would have extensive scoping rules where you would have sort of a nested structure, you could access variables from the calling subroutine and then from that calling, from the subroutine that called the calling subroutine and so forth, and they got a little bit out of control. Here it's totally different, again, because people thought about developing basically scientific libraries, and there was absolutely no interest in developing elaborate scope rules. So what this boils down for you to is that if you have integer I here, then it only lives within that function. There is absolutely no way of accessing it from the outside. Unless you, of course, transfer it through arguments. Okay, so, yeah?
So what happens when a variable goes out of scope to the memory?
Like, does it get garbage collected, basically, or do you have to take care of the memory yourself?
Ah, that's a question I don't want to answer. So there are certain things that could be said about it, but basically, I wouldn't trust anybody to answer. I've come by systems where when you call the function again, then the variables are there, just because no other procedure was called and overwrote the frame on the stack. But there's absolutely no guarantees for anything, and I would strongly doubt that this is something that's defined. Fortran doesn't have extensive memory management. So these garbage collection issues sort of don't really come up.
I have to delete my variables if I'm...
No, myself?
Or no. Is he going to just reuse the memory address and assume the
code? Well, so if that's your question, whenever it goes out, there's no... you don't have to... deallocate, and you can actually, so I'll tell you about that probably tomorrow. So Fortran looked at C++ and said, oh, we don't want to do that. So you can define dynamic arrays, so you just go in and say, well, I have an array, it should have that size, And then when you leave your subroutine or your calling program, then you usually deallocate. So you have those two statements. So memory allocation from that perspective in Fortran is much simpler. And the memory leaks, I haven't really seen that in Fortran 90. Is it a tremendous relief? Okay, so scope rules. If you want to program in Java or other fancy programming languages, then usually you should take a few moments and just have to have a look at what they might or might not say about their scope rules. So it's sort of a very useful concept. Okay, so now we want to, I told you, I was going to tell you two ways of avoiding writing interfaces. And so let me tell you the second way of doing this. When they made Fortran 90, they thought long and hard about the fact that a large part of the code that exists in Fortran is in library and is in the form of libraries. So they thought about a good way of sort of improving that. And what they decided to do was introduce something that's called one more thing I want to say. Sorry, I'll talk about that in 2 seconds here. When we talk about scope rules, then I also want to tell you about typing. So what is typing? Well, and why would that be a problem? And what do I actually mean by typing? So if I have a real here and then an integer, then we could think about what would happen when we encounter the statement that x is equal to I. So if you do that in most other programming languages, it'll just complain, right? Because I'm taking something that has a real as a type, and I'm trying to assign an integer to it, and those two types are different, so the compiler will complain. And that's called type checking. And for instance, in C, they wouldn't really allow you this from the perspective that under an operating system, why would you ever want to assign a real, an integer value to a real?
So there's no type coercion?
Here, this, in Fortran, this is just no problemo.
Well, that's fine at C, because there's no loss of precision, and so it's kind of
well, that's what you might think, right? I'll tell you more about these issues here. Fortran has what I would call permissive type checking. Again, because it's natural for us, if you look at a scientific formula from some book or whatever, then it doesn't seem any problem to assign an integer to a real. Things get more hairy if I do it the other way around, if I do something like this. And Fortran usually won't complain about that either. So that means that you're doing implicit type conversions. And you shouldn't do that. If you programmed in C, then you would know that there's something like a cast and so forth. But you really should be doing what's called explicit type conversions. And so if we want this, then at least we should tell ourselves and perhaps also the compiler that this is the behavior that we want. So I should say that it should take the integer and then convert it to a real. And this I write that way. So what it does is that it converts it into a real. Yes?
After these assignments, say x, what happens to the memory location of I and x? Because I presume I is pointing to me or you are pointing to the same value.
Well, yeah, what exactly will be happening here, and particularly with this statement here, that's, well, the best answer is try a little program and see what comes out. It will usually do implicit type conversion. So it'll sort of work the way that you think it should, but it'll be doing rounding according to the numerical precision. So for instance, if we set x here equal to 2.01, then I here is likely to be equal to 2, the integer value 2.
I'm talking about the memory.
Well, there's no problem with the memory here. These are just assignment statements.
He wants to know if I is going to point to x or if I no. gets the value. It doesn't.
No, these are just assignment statements. There are no. You can also do pointers in Fortran. But these are just assignment statements here. So what we mean is that I take the value that x has and then I copy it into I. Yeah, so in this case, you're always doing a copy. But the question we're trying to think about is these two have different types. If you have your, if you have some, well, no, so how should I say this? This is, in a certain aspect, very wonderful because it's sort of the way you would naturally think about how things should work. It turns out to be a source of problems, obviously, in the long run, because you end up forgetting about this, and then you just do something that has an ill-controlled behavior. So do these explicit type conversions. So I'm not gonna say much more about type checking here, except note that other programming languages would have strong type checking. You're looking at something with very weak type checking. Okay, so let me get to what I was going to tell you about before. And that's modules. So there was a decision to introduce something that is entirely new in Fortran 90. So somebody said yesterday, well, why didn't they just entirely redo Fortran? And you don't want to do that because you have legacy code lying around. But they allowed themselves to introduce something that didn't exist before. So apart from functions and subroutines, then we can have modules. And since modules never existed before, then we can do things in there that seems much more natural than before. So what modules are used for is basically building libraries. So I would have a module that I would call mymod here. I would then put an implicit none here. Then perhaps I would have a type declaration for something, so measurement and then int type here. And then I can do a contain statement. And after the contain statement, I do precisely what I did in my main program before. After the contain statement, I do function here, fun of x, where the result goes into value. And then I write out what that function might be. And then I do end function. And then I end my module. Okay. So this becomes quite useful because in the main program that again here is called test, all I have to do now if I want to use my function here, I don't have to put in a big interface declaration, etc. I just write use my mod here. Right? And then it'll actually now, it's quite interesting to see how a module here will compile, because if you run it through the compiler, it'll actually produce not a .o file, but a .mod file, and which we can't read either. But that will allow it to, when I encounter a statement where a here is equal to fun of x, it will have information about the actual function and its arguments and return values, so it can flag when things go wrong, even though this module might be in a separate file and they were compiled independently. So this is much cleverer than what we did before. No.
The interface information.
This
module.
Yes. So this is called an. So this is actually something that's important. This is an implicit interface declaration. And so let me just tell you this, that once I put a function here inside a module, I cannot then declare an explicit interface because there's already an implicit one. So it saves you a lot of typing, yeah?
Is this the closest to the transit classes and objects and stuff?
Yes. Yes, so you can obviously see where, first of all, this is great for libraries, and what we're going to do is that we're going to build a little class thing. So it's not classes that you might know them from other programming languages, but it's close enough. And so it was, again, well, C++ had been around for several years when they did that standard. So. So if you are working, so for this afternoon, you'll be doing some sorting algorithms that we should all know about. And obviously, you're going to stick them into a module here. And you can then use these sorting algorithms for many other things. There are two more things that I shouldn't tell you about, but I'm going to tell you about anyway. I could get the silly idea here. To maybe before my contain statement here, then I could write this statement real global A. So what that would mean is that I suddenly stuck in a real variable that I call global A here, and that would now be accessible from all program units that use that module. And this here would be what we would call a global variable. And if you have suffered through old style Fortran programming, you know that there's certain things that are called common blocks. And this is the irresistible urge that you get to create a common block. You do it this way. You stick them into a module, and then you put that module in all your subunits, and you think you're fine. It's just not a good programming practice to do this, and you should try to avoid it. But if you for some reason can't, then I also want to tell you that if you do this, you should start your module with a save here. Because you have effectively declared something here which is a global variable. And then you can get into very nasty behavior, because under the execution of your program, suppose the module here is only used by some subroutines, and these subroutines are not currently under execution, then that module actually goes out of scope, and there's no absolute guarantee that your global variable is not sort of going to turn into a ghost. So if you put this save statement here, and then you actually do get the behavior that it becomes a global variable that exists forever, and that might be what you want, yeah.
Can you define local variables in the module?
Yes, you can. So you can define So let's just look at this. Let's forget about that type statement here. I can go in, and then I can say, well, I don't want anybody to see that function here. So I'm just going to tell it that that function is private. The other thing is, of course, that I can go in here. So let's dig in my integer here, which was, or was it real before? Global I here. I can then go in here and say perhaps that I here is public. What this means, if you're not familiar with this from other programming languages, it's just a way of hiding things. If you don't want program units that are accessing your module, if you don't want it to be able to modify global I or to use the function, as I did here, then you want to declare it private. If you're familiar with classes and so forth, we're going to, for the homework, you're going to do a little class that shouldn't be too difficult to program. And in that case, you definitely want to declare something private. And we'll have a look at that when it comes. But basically, for now, you can think about, oh, this is just a great way. Whenever you have an external routine that you want to use and reuse, I just put module, end module around it with a contains, and it becomes a module. And I don't have to declare any interfaces. It'll check the arguments for you and make coffee in the morning, right? That's something that you should definitely do. Yes? Yeah, this variable? No, it's just a name. Just to indicate that it'll be accessible then from all programming units that call or have the statement use that module. Well, they won't in this. Oh, yeah, they do, because I declared it public. The default, by the way, here is this one. So if you don't do anything, everything is public.
If you've got,
I'll try to hide.
Okay, say you define something public,
like global I, and you don't put save at the top, because save is effectively like making it static. Do you get something that's equivalent to a sort of object's attributes out of it? Like, can you then have each program that uses my mod has its own global I?
This way, then you only get one variable that is accessible from all the modules.
But then, if that's the case, whether you put save or not, then why do you put save? Or is it just or is it without save, is it undefined behavior?
Let's just always put a save. And then, I don't, you know, it's just, then you're safe. If you put a save there, it'll work like a global variable. If you don't, then it might, but maybe not. Because you could have problems when it would go out of the scope. So that's the short answer to it. It happened to me once, and 3 weeks later, you've done that. Okay, so I want to tell you about the last thing here that you can do with module here. And that's because at this point, you're probably going to ask yourself, well, what is this interface statement good for? And that's because I can do what I call generic procedures, generic functions, and generic subroutines. Okay. So how would this work? Well, again, we write interface, but now we name it. So before we had just interface, and then we declared our function. Basically, it's calling variables and return variables inside, and that allows us to check the arguments and the return values for types and so forth. So I write interface here, and maybe this interface here, I want to call it swap here. That was the simplest thing I could think of here. Then I write in interface. Then I say to myself, well, I'm trying to write a module here, and that module should be running some sorting. Well, actually, let's call it something else. Let's just cut to the tutorial this afternoon. We want to write a sorting algorithm, but the sorting algorithm is going to look entirely the same whether I'm sorting integers or real here, right? So I put this in a module here. You have to, if you start writing modules, you have to come up with a good naming system for them. So I call my interface sort here, and then it contains routines here. That would be maybe a subroutine here that would do integer sorting, and then another subroutine that would do, that would sort a real array. And then there's some statements here. End module here. I guess I called it short mod here. So we just talked about the fact that the module here, it gave us an implicit interface here. And I told you that once we had an implicit interface, then I couldn't really define an explicit one. But I'm going to do that anyway, because what we can do here is I then here write the module procedure where these are keywords, if you like, and then we write int sort here, and then I write module procedure real sort. What will happen now is that over in my main program, I can now call a routine that is generic, which is just called sort. And it'll come in and it'll look at the interface and then it'll decide on which of these two routines to actually invoke based on the type of its arguments. So that's one simple example of what sometimes is called polymorphism here.
But we still have to explicitly write an implementation for every data.
Yes. You would like to do templates. It's probably coming at some point, but not today. So it's the poor man's version of polymorphism, but it works quite well. You mean?
I have something, and I don't know if it's some type.
I don't. I think you can probably do type of something. I have never combined it. We can have a look. It doesn't. I'll tell you about certain ways of doing it tomorrow, but they're more like the underlying hardware. Okay, so from the calling program here, then I would again just use my sort mod here, and then maybe I would have a real here, and it would be an array of 10 elements, and then I would have a number of integers, and maybe we want to call them k here. And then I can just go in and I can do call here, sort on A, and it'll pick out which one of these to use. That's why what we mean by generic. What else was I going to say here? So let me just tell you a little bit about when, if you try to do this here. Whatever you put into a named interface like this, of course, they all have to be procedures or they all have to be functions, right? You can't put a function here and a procedure there, right? It seems... was that too stupid?
Do you mean subroutine? What's going on when you change names?
Well, here... This here is a subroutine. They're both subroutines, right?
Yes. But okay, if they were both functions defined down there,
then they would be fine.
But we would still use the
keywords.
Yes. Okay. But I'm just telling you that. I could have a subroutine and a function here,
yes.
And I would try to combine them to something that wouldn't make any sense.
Like how tricky can you get though? Can a sort have four arguments and real sort have one, and have a third subroutine that has no arguments. They often have the same number of arguments.
The short answer is I'm not totally sure. I think you're probably going to be fairly limited. I just want to tell you two things here. So the Well, I told you already that what we have here should be all functions or all subroutines. So we want to look here at any two procedures. Of course, I could also, for instance, sort maybe complex numbers. I don't know precisely how we can even define that, but I guess you could try to. So I could have many here. I could have maybe four or five. So any two of these, if I look at two pairs here, they must be distinguishable. By reference to their non-optional arguments. I haven't told you about optional arguments, but if I have a real in a subroutine or a function, I can actually, and it's an incoming argument, I can declare it optional as another attribute. And maybe we have time to look at that tomorrow. But when for these generic procedures, so that's one part of your answer here. The arguments here, they should be non-optional. So at least one here. Must be of different type or position. Right. So I can have five arguments here, and one of them at least has to be of different type. Right. And or you can have five different types, and then the position is different. And that'll allow it to, so it's very simple. So that's any of these sort of object-oriented features of Fortran, basically you can think of, well, what would be the simplest possible way of doing it, and that's how they did it in Fortran. Okay, I'm not really gonna go there, but let me just end by saying one thing here, and that's the fact that when you look at these interface declarations, I can also do interface operator, and then for instance plus here, and then I could have a module procedure add, for instance, and then end interface. So for you, those of you who are not keen on object-oriented things, you can sort of forget about this. If you like doing things like this, then this here goes under the name of operator overloading. If you have two types that you have declared, which are not the standard types in Fortran, then you could think that maybe it would be a good idea to define an operator so I would be able to add them. Obviously, this can be done simply by calling a little subroutine that would do it for you, but then you want to put in some syntactic sugar, as it's sometimes called, that would allow you to write that A is equal to B plus C, and that would mean that you're overloading what plus means for those two types. And it can be done precisely sort of along those lines here by doing a declaration like this. And the other thing here that you can do here is that I can also overload the assignment operator. So if you have a very complex type, then you can overload that, and it sort of looks cool. I have this, so I have a little programming sample here that I pulled out from actually, by the way, let me show you this guy. So there's a book here that's called Object-Oriented Programming in Fortran 90, where they sort of took everything you could do in C++ and did it in Fortran, just to show off. It's very well done. And so I have one of the examples here for what you might want to do with this, and maybe I can make a copy for you. Or what I was hoping to do was put it on Proteus so you can actually just make a copy of it and play around with it. What it defines is what they call a class, which is just a module that defines rational numbers. So you can probably imagine that you would have a type which would have two integers, and those two integers would define a rational number. And then we could say, if I add two rational numbers, then I want to define what plus would be in that sense. Or if I set one rational number equal to another one, so forth. And you want to basically have the operations that you have on normal integers available on rational numbers. And that can all be done, but again, sort of in a slightly hardwired way, because at the end, you're actually going to end up writing explicit subroutines that would do the addition for you, so forth. So you can have a look at that, and I'll try perhaps to make that available, and I'm going to stop here.
Yeah, so if you were writing like a rational class module, you might want it, for example, you might want to have two different addition procedures, like one that reduces and one that doesn't. So can you create, in addition to overloading existing tokens or existing symbols, can you create like new, like a plus prime symbol that would like add and reduce?
You can do basically whatever you like, but it's not going to be as neat as you might expect from, for instance, C++. I can give you the example here for these. Most useful would be just to have it on Proteus so you can have a look at how they did it here. And one of them indeed does the reduction when you add
the user addition.
This one always does reductions, and there's only one addition. So I guess you're asking specifically how many of the symbols I can overload.
Well, whether you can create new symbols. Like my compiler right now doesn't recognize a dollar sign as anything, but could I create an operation with dollar sign?
Well, I would be guessing.
Okay.
So, but the best thing to do in cases like this is just, try and see what happens. That's because a lot of these features, they come into the standard. So Fortran 90 was, of course, proposed in 1990. I think it was finally passed the committee in 93. Or something like this. The first compilers that actually did this, some of these features became available in 2000. So the Fortran 2008 standard is not ratified yet. Before you can use any of that, sort of maybe 5 or 10 years from now. So there's a significant time lag, and what often happens with these new features is that they skimped a bit on implementing it. So you buy a compiler, and it'll say Fortran 90, 95, and it'll just, in small print, say most features of Fortran 95 were implemented, but not all of them. So there's sort of no telling really how things should work.
It just fully does.
Oh, okay. So you can, I can learn something. Okay.
You can't create
Let's go.
You can create